Support for the Projection Booth podcast comes from Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of the Projection Booth and thousands of other podcasts on the go without downloading or syncing. Stitcher instantly delivers episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone and Android app stores or on the web at stitcher.com/booth.
Сеймо право на джеврек. Jednima джеврек, drugima rupa od джеврека. Шалап! Изгледа да је основни проблем. Проблем рупе.
Погледајте до чега доводи класно друштво. Muškarci prestaju biti ljudi, postaju ordinarne svinje.
Znači, mi smo svi idioti.
Tačno. Idiotizam je prava reč za vašu situaciju. Jer ne činite ništa da izađete iz materijalne i seksualne bede.
Dođi da ti smestim mog idiota pa da se opameti.
More mato! Tucate pijane kurve po klozetima. Imate malu platu, žena i deca vas ne poštuju. Retko jebci.
Welcome to the Projection Booth. I'm your host, Mike White. Joining me is Mr. Rob St. Mary.
Now, you may have questions about organisms or orgasms, but I'm still trying to figure out how socks work, Uncle Joe.
This week, we're looking at Dusan Makhachev's WR, Mysteries of the Organism. The film tells several stories while telling one big one. It's the story of Wilhelm Reich, the psychoanalyst who worked alongside Freud and was the proponent of orgone, the cosmic energy which fuels us. The WR of the title also stands for World Revolution. Makhachev tells the story of Milena, a Slavic sex bot who, like Reich, equates fascism with frustrated sexuality. Along the way, Makhachev throws in footage of then-current sexual provocateurs, an old Soviet film about Stalin, propaganda films from the Nazis, and so much more. So, Rob, this was your first time checking out Makhachev, as far as I know. I was frothing at the mouth, practically, waiting to hear what you thought. Please fill me in.
You know, I had seen one of his films earlier, and it was one of the American films, because eventually he comes to the States, and I think I saw the Coca-Cola Kid, like, years ago on TV. I don't remember any of it. So I would say that this is probably the first time. And I have to say that it really kind of fits into a period of about 65 to 72. And what I mean by that is that at the time there was a lot of film exploration. There was a lot of experimentation. And I think it fits nicely in with people that I appreciate, such as Robert Downey Sr., who we had on. Obviously, you can go pull up the Putney Swope episode. And it kind of fits into that. It kind of fits into what some of the folks in New York were doing at the time, the underground film, and even Kenneth Anger. You know, I mean, I like Kenneth Anger too. But I think what's really interesting about what he has to say is obviously it is coming from a point of view of someone such as like Miloš Forman, who was working in Czechoslovakia under the thumb of the Soviets, much the same way that Makhachev was working in Yugoslavia at the time.
I was very lucky. I have been a fan of Makhachev since about 1993, I guess. I did not see Coca-Cola Kid until probably right around that time, but I had taken a college class called Introduction to Eastern European Cinema and had Herbert Eagle as my teacher. And I didn't realize at the time that Eagle is kind of a big deal when it comes to Eastern European cinema. It's like, you know, now I'll read articles and they'll be quoting him. And it's like, oh, okay, yeah, I had Professor Eagle. And he kind of took us on this nice journey into Eastern European cinema. He went through kind of country by country, Poland, Czechoslovakia, Yugoslavia. I'm not sure if we saw any Romanian films, but just kind of introducing us to a lot of really great filmmakers whose work I really never would have seen otherwise. So we got to see like Closely Watched Trains and Knife in the Water and The Apple Game and all this kind of stuff. And then he turned me on to Makaveyev, and it was just amazing. We saw Man Is Not a Bird and Love Affair, or The Case of the Missing Switchboard Operator, his two early films, and those blew me away. Man Is Not a Bird is just this really... It's like already he's coming out of a narrative shorts and documentary background, Makaveyev is, and he's already starting to mix documentary form with narrative form. It kind of reminded me of what Forman was doing at the same time, where he's kind of, you know, setting up this camera and recording live events with actors in them, you know, things like The Fireman's Ball or Loves of a Blonde. And with Makaveyev, he's kind of doing that, but he's also taking either documentary stuff that he's making or other pre-existing stuff and cutting it into his own work. So it's that whole montage thing that I love. And that really kind of comes to a head. Well, it comes to a head with Innocence Unprotected, which I saw years later, which was kind of a side-by-side of a old documentary and then the people who were in that documentary and just this kind of counterpoint with that. But for me, it really, my love really goes to WR, which I didn't see in class. I saw that years later when it played at a movie theater over in Windsor, and seeing that on the big screen blew me away, and I will never forget the first time I saw that one.
Well, you know, the thing that was funny, and I think I told you this either through Facebook or message or something like that, was I'm watching WR because I watched that one first, and about 10 minutes in, and I go, yeah, this is totally in your wheelhouse. And
yeah.
And what I meant by that was sort of if you've heard us talk about things like Mock-Up on Moo, like Craig Baldwin, with using quote-unquote found footage or stock footage and then sort of working that into a narrative with other things that are shot. And, you know, WR fits right in there because he's using all of those techniques and having these multiple threads. Some pay off, some don't, some loop back onto themselves in some way. And it's just sort of amazing to watch. And plus, as I was going to tell you, as I was looking at the front credits, it got my attention because I was not aware that there was a Bunuel Award at Cannes in 1971. So WR won the Bunuel Award. So you just have to have two drinks there because I just said it twice.
It was kind of controversial when the film came out. I mean, it never really came out in Yugoslavia. It really kind of, you know, they talk about how some movies weren't released, they escaped. Well, it kind of did escape, and it went out into the rest of the world, played at Cannes, played at all these different film festivals. But apparently, if you go back into Yugoslavian history, or the former Yugoslavia, I should say, it was kind of stricken from the record books and said that this film was never completed. So they just kind of took it away, even though it was making, you know, splashes all over the place. So, you know, we talked a little bit about censored film in the past, and this one was definitely, you know, censored in its own country. It was just not even acknowledged as ever being made.
See, that's nice. I like that they're not willing to even admit it.
Yeah, because it's somewhat critical of what was going on, but it was also just kind of you know, batshit crazy at times. So let's start talking about how the film, I think if we talk about the way that the film is structured, it will also talk about the way of what is in the film at the same time. We start off in New York with Tuli Kupperberg of the Fugs, I believe, going out and doing kind of a public performance, putting on this orange jumpsuit and this big frickin' helmet and carrying around a little toy M16. While on the soundtrack, we've got him doing a poem and then a song from the Fugs, if memory serves.
That is correct. It is a song from the Fugs. Also, we get in the New York scenes someone who will be rather obvious to you if you're if you know Warhol and his superstars. Jackie Curtis is also in there in the New York scenes.
So we get that kind of intro with Kupferberg, and then we go to outside of the city and we go to where Reich was living. Wilhelm Reich, a psychoanalyst from back in the day, kind of made his way over to the United States, very anti-communist, but yet accused here at home of being a communist. And really, it's kind of funny when you think about it. I mean, the movie was shot between 68 and 72, and Reich died, I believe, in 57. So you've got really not a whole lot of time between Reich's death and when this stuff was being shot and put out there, and has this amazing story that really nobody ever talks about. Like, I had never even heard of Wilhelm Reich before this movie came out. And we should note that he is not the guy who gave the Wilhelm its name.
The Wilhelm scream.
Though there's a lot of screaming in this movie.
That is true. And the one thing that Reich was really interested in was looking at not only just sort of, you know, humans and psychology and behavior and things like that, but he was focused on the idea that in some way the orgasmic energy, the sexual energy in some way focuses humanity or gets them to do things or things like that. And we're not just talking like behavioral, you want to have sex, but like sort of the releasing of orgasms leading to this sort of like energy. It almost seems like 10 years later when he was doing this film, you know, 10 years on from when Reich died, that was sort of that summer of love stuff, you know, like, oh, you know, I've seen the blue lights because I'm doing tantric sex.
Which is funny, since blue was like the color of orgasm to Reich. But yeah, it's interesting to see his story and just the way that it kind of plays out against stuff, and just the way that he was treated by the people in the small town where he was at, to hear them talk about the way that he thought of, you know, this kind of cosmic energy and how things are built up in people. And then the way that he kind of related this back to this like fascistic, you know, the denial of the orgasm for him was almost the embracing of this fascistic government dictatorship. You know, it was so much easier. Like, if you denied yourself pleasure, you could buy into the whole idea of a dictatorship so much easier. And it was just, I mean, it's heady stuff, and it's not something that's really easy to grasp right off the bat, but it's just like, oh, okay, there's actually some really amazing thought that's going into this stuff. And to hear people like quote from his papers and the people that have taken Reich's teachings and kind of gone on to do their own thing. It was, and that's one of the things that I really like about the film, is all the different doctors that they talk to that have moved away from Reich's teachings, or have used his teachings, I should say, and what they're doing then with them in this kind of late 60s, early 70s world.
And not only that, but you know, the film is structured on several different levels. So you have the folks in contemporary New York, you have this documentary on Wilhelm Reich, and then you have sort of people in Yugoslavia doing stuff. And all of these threads, there's either like long sections with them, or they cross back onto themselves and weave through in certain ways. And then you're left with ideas of, okay, he's introduced these ideas in the documentary, these ideas of what you were talking about, like sexual energy or orgasmic energy or organisms. And then what have we learned from that? And then I think he wants us to imply later into certain sections, maybe certain aspects of what we had seen previously.
Yeah, for Makaveyev, to me, the term that Professor Eagle used to always use was visual rhymes, and he would talk about how there were similar images that you could see as you kind of went through. They weren't necessarily the same image, and that's where the distinction came in, is that it was similar enough that it would have, if images had the ability to rhyme with one another, that's what it would be. So you get to see an image or an action take place in one scene that is very similar to something else. And so I think that Makaveyev was really kind of a master of that. And then he would do things where he would kind of force it a little bit where he would, you know, do things like tinting the frame, different things, you know, different colors. You would get some blue tinted things, mostly orange. We were getting a lot of orange tinted scenes, and those would kind of tie things together to make them all look like they're coming from the same body of work. Sometimes you would get orange tinted bits of The Vow, this Soviet film with Stalin, and then right next to it you would get an orange tinted scene of, you know, people making love or just these other things, one next to each other. Like, especially the thing that really got me was the plaster cast of the man's penis, which is this orange color, very deep orange, more of a red. And then the next thing you see is Stalin, and he has tinted that exact same red color. And we get Stalin going through this whole thing. Like, at one point when this ice skater, there's this whole plot with an ice skater over in Yugoslavia, when he slaps Milena, our main character from over there, you know, she sees Stalin in this kind of like otherworldly light and stuff. So we have like Stalin, and when he shows up, and it also kind of is a like a little signpost for us each time we get one of these little visual cues as we go through, like, you should really think about this in another way.
It's hard to say the exact statements, you know, like, is he saying this? Is he saying that? I mean, he's obviously making fun of Stalin in some way. I mean, to equate him, you know, color wise with a penis, I guess. And there's also this thing in there that I found kind of funny, is there's this couple and they're naked and they're like sort of rolling around and having sex like all over this room. And it's almost sort of like it's kind of like one level away from being sort of like stop motion funny. You know what I mean?
Yes.
And there's this like bizarro music, like this ethnic Slavic music or something on the soundtrack. And I don't think it's subtitled as to what the hell the song is. But I was getting the feeling that, and there was all this conversation about, you know, socialism and the proletariat and communism and all this. And I was thinking back to the first part of the film where they're talking about all this energy, you know, it's like energy, energy, energy. And I was thinking of maybe he was trying to make a statement about that communism is sort of this like orgasmic pleasure or something, like when you're in it and you're sort of immersed in it, you're sort of taken over by this feeling in some way. And we see sort of him battling the ideas where I would say with this movie, and then we'll also talk about Sweet Movie, which is another one that he did after that, I get the feeling that he's comparing and contrasting Yugoslavia under Soviet control and America. And at times I almost get the feeling he's giving the finger to both of them. It's almost like you both suck. It pox on both your houses.
Well, yeah, I think for him it feels like it feels more like he's talking about, to me anyway, Russia and the U.S., you know, these two huge superpowers, and just the way that both of them are effed up. And maybe to him, Yugoslavia is this place where things can change. But I think, you know, you get this Vladimir Ilyich character, you know, obviously named after Lenin, this ice skater who's coming from Russia and just spouting everything that he says is like the party line kind of thing. And just the way that he speaks down to Milena the entire time. And it's just this almost like, you know, oh, your whole brand of communism and everything, isn't that cute? You know, little pat on the chin kind of thing. Like, you know, you are really clueless as to how things really work, you know? And it feels like, to me anyway, that's what Makaveyev is saying, is like, you know, that no one is really taking Yugoslavia seriously, that it's trying to abide by tenets that were put out there by, you know, the early communist leaders and everything. And maybe it shouldn't necessarily follow those, because maybe the people that put those out there were fools, but they're trying and they're kind of being squeezed between two worlds.
And one thing also that's a pretty heavy theme or idea that he's trying to hammer, and this is the thing that we talk about with the stock footage or the found footage, is there's footage of, once again, Stalin in this film, and there's also footage of mental institutions, what it looks like. And there's people being force-fed, there's people being electroshocked, And you sort of get the feeling that it's almost like, in order to accept Stalinism, this is the kind of thing you have to do. Like, you have to be forced to accept it.
Yeah, that was actually footage that from Nazi propaganda that was in support of euthanasia. Like, instead of, say, you know, their line was, instead of spending all this money on these hopeless cases, we should just kill all these people. So, which is brings another whole level to the proceedings. But yeah, his use of that is fascinating. And then also the way that, again, he's counterpointing, like, the guy who gets the electroshock, and he's there kind of doing this, like, seizure kind of thing. And then they cut back to the United States with people in these, like, clinics for, you know, release of energy kind of thing. And they're doing almost the exact same thing. You know, it's like they're moving their hips all around, and they're screaming, and, you know, just the woman who's, like, holding onto the towel and screaming, you know, give it to me, and just, like, all this insanity is going on throughout all this kind of stuff.
And I'm sure this doesn't make any sense to anyone who hasn't seen the film. Like I said, it just, if you haven't seen WR, you really need to sort of stop the podcast, go watch it, and then come back, because otherwise it just sounds crazier and crazier, the things that we're talking about.
I mean, really, when you break it down, there's like two major sections of the film. You know, there's the first part, which is basically a documentary about Wilhelm Reich. And then there's the second part, which is this narrative about these two chicks living in an apartment in free loving Yugoslavia. But then all of this other stuff that he adds to it, and the way that he cuts back and forth from one thing to another, that's where you get this level, you know, or multiple levels, really, of where all this kind of commentary from one to another and these strings, though tenuous as some of them may be, but the way that these threads go through everything, and it just, you know, it makes the experience so much richer. You know, we should talk a little bit more about Reich. The thing that I didn't know about Reich was that he was prosecuted by the United States and that he was thrown in jail. And it was the Food and Drug Administration that came after him. It wasn't the FBI, wasn't any of these other kind of things, but the FDA are the ones who said, all your stuff is wrong. You know, there is no such thing as orgone, and all these things that you're doing are, you know, quack medicine. And they're the ones who managed to get him thrown in jail and get all of his books burned, even the ones where he wasn't talking about orgone.
Yeah, it's just amazing sort of history that I would say is probably forgotten. Like, most people don't know about that kind of history.
Yeah, it reminded me a little bit, you know, since we've just done the two episodes about Scientology. I don't know if it was just a timing thing or what, you know, if he had been around like 10 years later, if Reich could have started a whole new religion in the United States. But it felt like some of the stuff that they were showing with like the funnels and all this kind of stuff and the orgone collector, I was just like, wow, you call that an e-meter instead, and you got something, buddy.
Didn't he name the state Oregon?
That whole state. That's where all the Oregonians live now, and they like to censor films. Oh, wait, no, that's Utah.
The thing that's also interesting to me is that you have people in there in the New York City section where you have, like, Betty Dodson, who is still out there. She's a pro-sex activist. And then also Al Goldstein shows up, although he doesn't really speak much. It's more like there's things shot in the Screw magazine offices.
Yeah, you get to see Al Goldstein with a fake vagina rubbing it across his face, and it's just like, ugh.
Yeah, and he's kind of sleazy on his own. I mean, one of the best autobiographies I ever read of a publisher is Al Goldstein's Screwed, which is just an amazing book. Whether you like Al Goldstein or not, it's a great read.
I just watched Let My Puppets Come the other day for the Meet the Feebles episode of the Badasses, Boobs, and Body Counts podcast, and got to see him in there. And just like, he was only in the movie for about 30 seconds, but he gave one of the worst performances I could believe.
If you want to see a really great Al Goldstein performance, Citizen Toxie, he plays Ron Jeremy's like advisor, the mayor of Tromaville, played by Ron Jeremy. And he's like constantly on the cell phone and doing stuff. He doesn't really do anything. He's just sort of like local color.
Yeah, he is a very fascinating character, and yeah, I've seen him in documentaries before, and he's hilarious, and he's so not a sex symbol, but I really kind of appreciate that, just kind of like Ron Jeremy.
One of the things I was really excited about with this film, in you alluded to the front end, was the Fugs, was having the Fugs in there, and their song "Kill for Peace." Now, I didn't know that song all that well. I'm more familiar with CIA Man and a few other things, and I had interviewed a few years ago when I was in Detroit. I had a chance to interview with Ed Sanders of the Fugs, and Ed Sanders is an amazingly interesting guy. He has a new autobiography out called Fug You, I believe is what it's called, and he started back in the early 60s a magazine in New York. It was sort of the early go of zines in the underground press. He was sort of an innovator in that. It was called Fuck You, a Literary Journal. And that was the title of the magazine. And that led to, obviously, some trouble in 1961, 62, 63, whenever he started it. And the authorities kept cracking down on him and his PSI bookstore that he had and things like that. And he went on to be a big inspiration and also a friend to people such as John Sinclair, who in Detroit history and in Detroit art and culture is rather well known. He was the manager of the MC5, but also a poet and a writer in his own right. And like I said, it was just a great chance to talk to Ed Sanders and to learn more about the Fugs and all of that stuff. So it was great that they were in here, because their music is I think that they lead a certain example of humor, sort of like Frank Zappa in a way at times, but a little more biting, if that's even possible, and definitely a much more ragged sound than Zappa, who was, you know, a great,
oh, yeah,
great jazz player, really, when you consider what he was doing. And I would say that the Fugs were probably an inspiration on punk rock in later days, at least in terms of ideas and sort of giving the finger to establishment.
Well, yeah, I can really see a clear line between the Fugs and like a Dead Kennedys, you know, that level of absurdism. It still always boggles my mind, the PMRC coming down on the Dead Kennedys and thinking things like "I kill children" or "stealing people's mail" or any of those were meant literally rather than with this, you know, tongue firmly placed in the cheek. So something like that versus "kill for peace," you know, it's like, yeah, that totally makes sense. Yeah, the Fugs are just like this really, people just don't know about them, which is really kind of sad. Like, I remember I was so excited when I finally watched the Holy Moly Rounders documentary, Born to Lose. Unfortunately, those are really kind of not very good documentary, but they mentioned the Fugs a couple times, and there was this kind of relationship with them and everything between them and the Rounders, and I was really hoping they would get into that, but unfortunately, like a lot of things with that documentary, they did not. So I'm still hoping that like that kind of definitive Fugs documentary is in the works or coming down pretty soon.
Yeah, I would have to say that probably the most mainstream use of the Fugs in recent years, for anyone who isn't familiar with them, would probably be CIA Man was actually used in, I think it was Burn After Reading, the Coen Brothers movie.
We are going to take a break and play an interview that we did with Professor Lorraine Mortimer, the author of Terror and Joy, the films of Dusan Makhachev.
There is a place where Raffinet performs, rub shoulders with wrestling women and mad doctors. There is a place where domestic dwellings are terrorized by killer beds and satanically possessed appliances. There is a place where nations battle for survival whilst tasty geezers with shooters and football hooligans run riot upon the streets. There is a place where the underdog strives for sporting glory, whilst hitmen and vampire motorcycles go on curses of bloody revenge. There is a place where Nicolas Cage punches a bear in the face. The name of the place? The Crash and Burn Movie Podcast, of course. www.crashandburnmoviepodcast.co.uk. Be there. And listen to us waffle on. You may be entertained.
Do you like movie reviews that are insightful, thought-provoking, and delivered by somebody who's trained to critically dissect every aspect of a motion picture without ever having to use obscenities?
Then you've got the wrong Show. Kruger Nation Horror Podcast is ready to feed your slasher movie and exploitation needs. There'll be more blood, expletives, and titties than you can shake your grandma's beetle flaps at. Visit www.krugernation.com.
Oh, good God! A butthole casserole!
Life is so busy. From my job to my family and all the things in between, sometimes you need to make a little time for yourself. And I found something nice to make those times oh so sweet. It's Vibrators.com. Vibrators.com has the perfect products for women, men, and couples. And if you're new to all this, they have plenty of helpful suggestions and information to make sure you get something just right for you. Plus, for over a decade, Vibrators.com has taken your privacy seriously. Go to the site and read all about it. And right now, when you use the special code BOOTH, that's B-O-O-T-H, at checkout, you'll receive free priority shipping on any order from Vibrators.com's huge catalog. That's Vibrators.com. Do something nice for you.
I know you've done some translations of Edgar Morin in the past. What brought you to Makaveyev?
Oh, even before Edgar Morin, I'd started to get interested in Makaveyev's work, seeing WR as the first of his films in about 1972. I only got put on to Edgar Morin's work in about 1986 or 7 when I was doing my PhD.
What was your approach when it came to Makaveyev? And also, what was the moment when you said, okay, I need to write a book about this?
I probably at first never thought I was the person who'd write a book all those years back. When did I need to write? Possibly when I read Simon Callow's book in 19... When was that put? When did that come out? 1990 or something, maybe. When I was given that to review, I think I might have already been thinking a great deal about Makaveyev's films, obviously because they really struck a chord in me and I was on the same wavelength in many, many ways. But when I read Callow's book, I was asked to do a review of it, and I looked up Makaveyev when I was in Paris. I only just found out from Callow's book that Makaveyev was in Paris. I was in Paris to see Edgar Morin, in fact, in the days when universities paid your fare for that sort of thing. I thought I might as well look him up. So I wrote to him in French, forgetting that he had English. And he rang back to my place, got my husband who didn't speak French, so it nearly didn't all happen. But eventually Dushan and I met up and we really got on fantastically and decided that I might as well do a book.
So you primarily concentrate on his early stuff. Did you ever think about doing a sequel with his later works in there?
I have indeed written a chapter on the Coca-Cola Kid, which I don't think is as strong, but I was persuaded by some younger people at Charles University in Prague, given that I was Australian, to write about his Australian film. And I thought, well, that's reasonable to ask me. And I have written a chapter on that film, which is in the Serbian version of the Makaveyev book, not in the Minnesota Press one. So that's been added to the Serbian version. And that chapter will come out at some stage in another book.
Well, that's very cool. I'm glad to hear that there's hopefully another edition coming out sometime.
Hey, if you can write to Minnesota Press and say, that'd be really good, because I did write to them and tell them that was available, and they were saying, oh, look, we really value your book, but they see it as very much a minority audience book. But given that it's in Serbian, I'd like to get it into French. I would love to see that chapter go in, because I think it's not a bad chapter, actually. In the end, I think I was able to make a pretty decent chapter, yeah.
So as you were doing this research for everything, what kind of stuff did you find out about the Yugoslavian film industry? What was going on around the time that WR was coming out?
I really learned more about that as I went along and as I read Daniel Golding and Herbert Eagle and people like that. So I was able to get a really pretty good picture of the stuff going on in Czechoslovakia and former Yugoslavia. But I don't know what it was like for you, maybe studying with Eagle, it was a bit different. But I wasn't able to get copies of a lot of the films that were talked about in these books.
It is a shame that it's still so difficult to get so many of those films. And then with the war and everything, nobody seems to know where anything is at.
That's right. What I will do, though, is I'm actually going to go back to Belgrade early next year. I've got a conference in Pula in Croatia later in the year and on other stuff. And I'm going to go back to Belgrade and I'm going to go to the Yugoslav Cinematheque, see all Makaveyev's earliest films, the amateur ones and docos. And as well as that, I may even be able to get onto some subtitle versions of some of the other ones. Yeah, yeah.
There's the longstanding debate as far as which is the movie you go back to with him. Is it WR or is it Sweet Movie? Which one is it for you?
Probably WR being the original and the most baffling to me. But I do think, I hope you like the Sweet Movie chapter, because I do think it was wonderfully, the film was wonderfully complex and much more difficult at the beginning to kind of like. But I'd say WR, maybe Switchboard Operators, my favourite of all the films, and a lot of the Belgrade people felt like that. But then when I watch Montenegro, I love it as well.
You got to talk to Makaveyev. Did you talk about like the making of the film?
Oh, I, over the years, talked a great deal about it. And you find out more all the time, in fact. And I suppose when everybody was gossiping in Belgrade, I found out even more. Because everybody, you know, people there are as nutty as I am and sort of talk as loudly and gesticulate a lot and still remain friends. You know what I mean? They can be critical of each other and remain friendly. But in 1991, it was, in fact, in Paris, that Makaveyev told me a great deal about the making of the film, yeah. So I learned quite a lot at that stage.
Dish, come on, let's hear it.
Well, for example, fascinating little things like, you know, Miss World. First of all, she was supposed to be making, she was supposed to be with a lover. And I was supposed to be making love and all the children, there were a whole lot of children who were supposed to be licking chocolate off their bodies or something like that. And, of course, Carol Law, as you know, left the production anyway. But she had a new boyfriend who was incredibly jealous of her sort of being nude on the set in any way and watching on. And the lover was gay, the screen lover was gay anyway, so it was all very awkward and terrible. So in the end, I sort of love, it's fascinating the way you do get, she walks out eventually, having done a lot of really good material, she walks out eventually and there's a court case about it. Then Makaveyev falls on his feet by ending up having those two streams, the one with Anna Prucknell as Anna Planeta, and Carol Laura's Miss World. So I kind of love the way I'm talking about Sweet Movie endlessly, aren't I? Because probably, yeah, instead of WR, sorry. That's because that's the one that Makaveyev started really talking and as well as gossiping with me about. With WR, I do know, but I think I said in the book, in fact, that Tito really said to Milena Dravic that she shouldn't be in such films. I found out the people from all over the world who had really protested against it not being in circulation anymore in Yugoslavia and the Eastern Bloc, even though it could be seen around the world. And these were people who were very, very prominent. I learned about it being sabotaged rather than banned. So I learned a lot of the nuts and bolts about the film and about the long, long, long court case that happened with the film. I don't know that I think there was much more gossip I learned with WR. I never met Milena Dravic, but I did meet some of his other actors while I was in, and was on panels with them while I was in Belgrade. So all of these things were just phenomenal. Someone like Eva Raz from Switchboard Operator, she is still on television and doing really interesting, very critical things, critical of nationalism, critical of government corruption, et cetera, et cetera. So I think I just learned a great deal altogether. And, of course, his wife, spending time with his wife, Bojana Marijan, who was a really important part of the whole thing.
Now, she did the music for a lot of his films, right?
She did the music for a lot of his films. She is also the gorgeous young blonde woman dressing Tuli Kupferberg when he's sort of going around Greenwich Village in WR, doing guerrilla theatre type stuff with his rifle. And she's both more organised than Dusan. She's obviously a long-suffering woman with his chaos. and she's done all the music. And when I was there in Belgrade for me, she actually put on music by Tim Finn, who did the music for the Coca-Cola Kid. She absolutely thinks about this a great deal, as well as being assistant director on some of the later film. And indeed, when I was just rereading what I'd written, because I've been obviously writing a lot of other stuff since then and working with different people, when I just read the stuff about Teach Your Children Well and the Fugs and some of the ads of the time and Jackie Curtis, I actually got all these incredible feelings from the time, because I was that was absolutely the time of my youth. So I'm 63 now. McAvey's a certain age, more certain amount number of years older, but he was discovering the United States, and this was a culture that was important all around the world and the movements there. I guess one of the things that interests me greatly, though, is from my point of view, quite a few people in the English-speaking world did see the film then as let it all being just sort of let it all hang out and being an emblem of the times rather than an emblem of the times and a lot more.
How was it seeing this in 1972 when you saw it?
Well, the first time I saw it, I didn't have a clue what was happening. And I think I said in the intro to the book, I was lucky enough to have a fanatical friend, an anarchist who knew a great deal about Yugoslavia and autonomy, workers' control movements, etc. And he didn't like the film itself. He didn't like Wright much, but he went to that film five nights in a row. So the first time I met him, we talked about this film, which I found totally puzzling but was drawn to, and which he'd seen, several times, and not liking Wright, but still liking a lot of what was in the film. So, yeah, it was a knockout and just totally baffling to me right at the beginning, and similarly with my kids, of course. But what my younger son, for example, I love the fact that when he first went to the Australian Ballet School a certain number of years ago, he'd show this film to other people to show his avant-garde credentials, and they'd all be knocked out by it. And, this is only 10 years ago. So it still tends to astound people.
It always takes me aback, the whole story of Reich, and just that is not well known. I mean, other than this film, I can't really think of very many people talking about that. I mean, book burning in the U.S. is crazy.
It's great, isn't it? And I love Reich saying, I should be judged by a jury, legally, not by a cosmetic people concerned with cosmetics like the Food and Drug Administration. And the fact that, Jacques Lacan is so well known and used in film studies, and people talk about Freud, but Reich's just not well enough known still. And yet, for heaven's sake, I don't think you can talk about toxic identity movements and religio-political movements without thinking a bit, seriously about a lot of Reich's theories.
And I like the way that he kind of ties in the ideas of, the feelings you get from fascistic movements and the earth, and just, so many great ideas that just seem to have been kind of cast by the wayside.
I agree, and yet are so relevant to now, with all kinds of zeal being poured into all sorts of things that ain't healthy. And I was rereading a thing that Reich said about masochism flourishing like a bad weed in patriarchal religions and ideologies. And, that is so true, it's not funny. This kind of anti-life thing and the whole notion of, sacrificing now for the future, et cetera, et cetera. That's also true. And the fact that also Reich wrote The Mass Psychology of Fascism, realizing how attractive fascism could be, exactly as you say, about people getting lost in this wonderful cosmic feeling together, and people sort of seeming radiant, the Nazis being seen as radiant and so lively, even by Polish people whose country they were going into. Yeah, I think it's so relevant, yeah. But I also think that's part of the thing of people being able to discredit really radical ideas. I think it was McAvey who said that Eric Fromm presented a more sort of tame UN-style version of the fear of freedom, whereas Reich's was more fundamental and much stronger and more savage, yeah. Sadly, even in my cinema studies department many years ago, some of the people tutoring on the film didn't really get that McAvey was actually you know, having an ironical thing there of Milena having a touch of the fascistic thing about her presentation at the same time being right onto all of these things. I guess the film was, in the end, in many ways, a bit too subtle for people who often end up wanting sort of your black and white or, you know, your either or, Manichean sorts of things, yeah. Yeah, I don't mean they're idiots by that. I think human beings, all of us, seem to tend to handle those dichotomies a bit more easily than muddying it up.
Well, speaking of dichotomy, I also like the gender bending that Milena is doing, and, well, along with Jackie Curtis, of course, in the film, but Milena with her flak jacket and her slip and her cigar and her hat and everything, and just such a beautiful woman who's using some of those trappings of masculinity.
That's fantastic. And I think, again, he does all sorts of things like that in the other films too, Switchboard Operator, which, you know, I actually showed the strudel-making scene, which I think is a triumph, yeah, right from the beginning to the end, at a paper I gave on the post-human question mark in an anthropology conference a couple of weeks ago. And it was really fascinating that a couple of young people in the audience straight away assumed, oh, it's a pre-feminist film because she's making strudel, the woman's making strudel for her lover. And it was just wonderful to be able to talk to him about the fact that, well, she's doing something she loved. McAvey asked her to do something she loved with her lover. But she also, of course, there's a tragedy that ensues because she doesn't want to bear him a little hero, a little party man. And so, you know, the fact that people can have those knee-jerk reactions kind of, again, denies the complexity of these things. So I find myself always coming back to talk about that complexity because people can even, you know, even now, or obviously now still nothing's changed that much, have those knee-jerk reactions. And what was lovely was the young people who said they'd thought that took the point. It doesn't necessarily mean she was a domestic slave. Far from it, yeah.
Let's talk a little bit more about the lawsuit that you mentioned around WR. Can you talk about that a little bit more?
As you'd have known, the film was actually passed for distribution after it was made, but then there was to be a screening and discussion in Vojvodina, in Novi Sad, which was stacked with old veterans and people who were more conservative. And at that meeting, people decided it was completely unrespectful to the Yugoslav past. They weren't necessarily old Stalinists, the people, but they thought it was not respectful to Yugoslav ideals, et cetera, taking these things so frivolously. And they actually decided, the Regional Cultural Commission's executive committee decided that from now on it had to be banned. It was removed from circulation within Yugoslavia, even though the world had found it interesting and it had won many prizes. And then after that it was banned, wiped from the official register of films produced in Yugoslavia, and it said it was never finished. And that was signed by the president of the Filmmakers Union. And obviously, people wanted to keep their jobs. I mean, we could go back to Eisenstein and a lot of Russian filmmakers in these ways. And the lawsuit, I don't know what happened finally with the lawsuit, but the lawsuit was precisely about the fact that it had been passed. And yet this ban came into being, but he was still showing it, but then they sabotaged it. There would, in a projection booth that he was to go to, the keys would be missing, et cetera, et cetera. Meanwhile, critics who were critical or who still, again, wanted a democratic socialism in former Yugoslavia, they still used to translate reviews of WR from overseas. And so it was still known about very well and shown secretly. So I think it was about 1992, was it, that it was shown on Yugoslav television finally. And we saw it on our television too, slightly amended, with the goldfish swimming over Jim Buckley's erect penis when he's having the plaster cast made. So, again, McAvoyev censored his own film, but I think incredibly well.
Did you talk to McAvoyev as far as him kind of being a was he officially in exile or more of a self-made exile from Yugoslavia?
That's a great question. A self-made. He said he was condemned to labor abroad, basically. When the Croatian Spring occurred, when Brezhnev leaned on Tito to get rid of someone like McAvoyev and quite a few other Serbian artists and intellectuals critical of the regime. Tito, more conservative people came into power. You know, Tito did a constant juggling act between Serbs and Croats in the country. And more conservative people got into power. And in order to appease these people and to also do what Brezhnev said at the time, because he was always juggling, it was never easy, Makeyev would have gone to jail at that time, and he was not able to work in his own country anymore. So what Lazar Stojanovic, who made Plastic Jesus, which I've never seen, what he said in a Harvard newspaper collection of articles on Makeyev came out years ago, and Stojanovic said in that collection a beautiful thing. He was saying, you know, Makeyev was so not bitter and so decent and so creative and committed still. He used to keep going back to Belgrade and talking to people, making appearances as if nothing had happened, as if he hadn't been banned from working there and wouldn't have gone to jail in the past. And he lived in Paris, but he wasn't formally exiled. It's just that he would have gone to jail at the time, at the earlier time in 1973, and he couldn't work. He lives in Belgrade again now as an old – he and Bojana are back there as old people, yeah.
That sounds so quaint.
It is amazing, isn't it? I mean, what I couldn't believe, Mike, was that in their Belgrade house, when I did go over for the Serbian translation of the book being launched, I was meeting all of these old people who were legends as far as the film of the 60s were concerned, and people who had known Tito, argued with Tito, didn't go to the right, like my friend who actually did see WR five times. He's gone to the right now, and you can't really talk to him about these issues, but these people just kept on keeping on in difficult circumstances, but they're so full of life and integrity and intelligence. So it's as if Makeyev sort of never left Belgrade as far as his circle of friends and people he deals with. Yeah, it is quaint, but, I mean, it's quite inspiring too, yeah.
Now, I know you're fluent in French. Did you pick up any Serbian while you were doing all this research?
Well, you might gather that I'm a bit of a nut. When people said to me there, how come an Australian's doing this? I said, well, maybe I'm not Australian, maybe I'm from another planet. I actually started learning Russian 13 years ago to exercise my aging brain, and I got seduced by the language. So even though it would have been much more logical to have learned what was Serbo-Croatian, I went for Russian, which still gave me access to a great deal of Serbo-Croatian. Now, however, I'm actually also learning Croatian, but that's because it's the best in between for Bosnian and for Serbian. So, again, I'm pretty stupid at 63 trying to learn Serbian, but I'm a bit compulsive and I can't actually live in a place without trying to learn the language, sort of out of respect, yeah.
We're back. We're talking about WR, Mysteries of the Organism. And one of the things that was funny, Mike, when you said, you know, you got to watch this and I'm waiting to see what your reaction is you go, not only going to watch this, but I'm going to have you watch Sweet Movie as well. And I think I'm going to get my revenge on you later in the year. So get ready to drink with Buñuel is when I said, not only do you need to watch The Discreet Charm, but you should probably watch Exterminating Angel, because to me, those two sort of share a similar philosophy in a way. And I think that that's what you were going for with Sweet Movie here.
Yeah, Sweet Movie was not made in Yugoslavia. This was a French production. And the movies share a lot of similarities as far as kind of, again, some of the structural elements that he's doing, some of the commentary on world politics that he's doing, and just, I don't know, I feel like these two films really kind of go together, but I have to say that between the two, I always go back to WR. There's something about Sweet Movie that doesn't necessarily appeal to me that much. I don't know if it's kind of the scatological angle of it or what it is, but I don't go back to Sweet Movie as much as I should. So I'm curious, what did you think about it?
I just want to go through it real quick because to me, I think he's talking, like, rightfully so. I think he's talking to similar things. I think in this movie, this is where I really felt he was given the finger to, you know, the East and the West. Because you have, within Sweet Movie, it starts off with There's this woman and she's singing this song, and then there's like this TV show and it's almost like Miss America or something, and it's supposed to be a Miss World contest. And but the thing is that in order to judge who like Miss World is going to be, it's on TV live gynecological exams. So they're brought in, yeah, they're dressed up and everything, but it's like getting the stirrups and the doctor's going to look at you and he's basically poking and prodding. We don't see anything, but you know, it's all implied. And this whole idea of this being brought to you by the Chastity Belt Foundation and everything, and sort of this commoditization, if that's even a word, of women, especially below the belt, and that then leads into the winner marrying this the guy who is the son of the Chastity Belt Foundation. This you know, sort of, I guess if they could have got Phyllis Diller, she would have been great as the head of the Chastity Belt Foundation, because this woman kind of reminds me of her a little bit, and marries this guy who obviously he's a Texan. So he's got like, you know, a cowboy hat on and everything like that. So of course he represents, you know, real America, you know, kind of thing. And played by John Vernon, which I fucking love John Vernon. I mean, if you know who John Vernon is, I mean, he's the dean in Animal House. He's the chief of police in Dirty Harry. So it was just amazing to see him just pop up in this like odd little movie. And he's like so happy that he's found that there's this whole thing about not only is she a virgin, but she's beautiful as well. And she's clean. And it's like, and that's so rare these days to find and all this. And just this sort of idea of commoditization of sex. And when they get together for like, I guess it's supposed to be like the honeymoon night or whatever, he has this whole thing with rubbing alcohol where he like rubs himself down with rubbing alcohol and starts rubbing her down with rubbing alcohol. So just like I was just getting this whole thing about the idea of just the body being commodity. And this also goes later on into certain things, which in a way kind of although I'd have to say it's much happier and brighter, almost like Salo. It's like similar ideas of what Pasolini's talking about in Salo in terms of the body as commodity or shit as process of the body as commodity and things like that. So so there's all of these things like that. I'll tell you one thing that's really interesting about Sweet Movie over WR is it's beautifully shot. It looks a lot like it looks a lot cleaner, beautifully shot, staged. He obviously had some money with this. You get the idea that maybe the other one was kind of put together on 16mm when he had a little money to put together.
We should probably note that John Vernon being this, you know, Texas, we'll be talking about Mr. Freedom later on, but he seems like he's right out of Mr. Freedom, this kind of like over-exaggeration of America. And his name is Mr. Capital. You know, you don't get any more American than that. Spelled with a K, like Das Kapital. So that kind of plays into the second half or the second part of the movie, which is this woman going down the canals of Amsterdam on this boat. And she's got this huge Karl Marx head on the front of the boat with his, you know, the beard kind of dragging in the water and everything. And she's like this, almost like a siren who wants to seduce and kill people that with all the sweets that she has inside of her boat.
Yeah, and she meets this young sailor who is dressed like one of the sailors from Battleship Potemkin. And she refers to him as Potemkin, and I think that might even be what's written on his hat.
Yeah, and who's played by Pierre Clemente, who's a great cult actor, has been in a ton of stuff, and he's one of these guys where he can look completely different from role to role. So it's like, if you don't recognize that Clemente is in this film, you know, that's not a surprise. He was actually in a Buñuel film, Rob, Belle du Jour.
Ah, very nice. Take another drink.
I don't know if it counts when I say it.
You have this whole thing where she's got this boat full of sweets. And I was trying to get the idea once again of like seduction, you know, both in the physical sense, but also in sort of the culinary sense, I guess. And the idea of junk food. you know, that something is junk food. You know, too much of that stuff will, you know, rot your teeth or...
We're sorry, but we've run out of time. Be sure to listen to the rest of this episode at jackaloperadio.com in the Projection Booth archives. And be sure to leave your feedback at projection-booth.com. Stay classy.